Within your mind, there can be no such differentiation as this one is mine and that is another's, because you are the supreme absolute truth, the soul of all beings, always equipoised and enjoying transcendental happiness within yourself. Just like the heavenly desire tree, you bless all who properly worship you, granting their desired fruits in proportion to the service they render you. There is nothing wrong in this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Your decision is perfect, O King, and thus your noble fame will spread to all the worlds, O tormentor of your enemies." Indeed, my Lord, for the great sages, the forefathers, and the demigods, for our well-wishing friends, and indeed for all living beings, the performance of this King of Vedic sacrifices is desirable. First, conquer all kings, bring the earth under your control, and collect all the required paraphernalia. Then execute this great sacrifice. These brothers of yours, O King, have taken birth as partial expansions of the demigods ruling various planets, and you are so self-controlled that you have conquered even me, who am unconquerable for those who cannot control their senses. No one in this world, even a demigod, what to speak of an earthly king, can defeat my devotee with his strength, beauty, fame, or riches." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, King Yudhisthira became joyful, and his face blossomed like a lotus. Thus he sent forth his brothers, who were empowered with Lord Vishnu's potency, to conquer all directions. He sent Sahadeva to the south with the Srinjayas, Nakula to the west with the Matsyas, Arjuna to the north with the Kekayas, and Bhima to the east with the Mudrikas. After defeating many kings with their prowess, these heroic brothers brought back abundant wealth for Yudhisthira Maharaj, who was intent on performing the sacrifice. When King Yudhisthira heard that Jarasandha remained undefeated, he set to pondering, and then the primeval lord Hari told him the means Uddhava had described for defeating Jarasandha. Thus Bhimasen, Arjuna, and Krishna disguised themselves as Brahmins and went to Girivraja, where the son of Brihadratta was to be found. Disguised as Brahmins, the royal warriors approached Jarasandha at home during the appointed hour for receiving guests. They submitted their entreaty to that dutiful householder, who was especially respectful to the Brahminical class. Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima said, "O King, know us to be needy guests who have come to you from afar. We wish all good unto you. Please grant us whatever we desire. What can the tolerant not bear? What will the wicked not do? What will the generous not give in charity? And who will those of equal vision see as an outsider? He indeed is to be censured and pitied, who, though able to do so, fails to achieve with his temporary body the lasting fame glorified by great saints. Harishchandra, Rantidev, Unshavriti Mudgala, Shibi, Bali, the legendary hunter and pigeon, and many others have attained the permanent by means of the impermanent." Shukadev Goswami said, "From the sound of their voices, their physical stature, and the marks of bowstrings on their forearms, Jarasandha could tell that his guests were of the royal order. He began to think he had seen them somewhere before." Jarasandha thought, "These are surely members of the royal order dressed as Brahmins, but still I must grant their request for charity, even if they beg me for my own body. Indeed, the spotless glories of Bali Maharaj are heard throughout the world. Lord Vishnu, wishing to recover Indra's opulence from Bali, appeared before him in the guise of a Brahmin and made him fall from his powerful position. Though aware of the ruse and forbidden by his guru, Bali, king of the demons, still gave Vishnu the whole earth in charity. What is the use of an unqualified Kshatriya who goes on living but fails to gain everlasting glory by working with his perishable body for the benefit of Brahmins?" Thus making up his mind, the generous Jarasandha addressed Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima. "O learned Brahmins, choose whatever you wish. I will give it to you, even if it is my own head." The Supreme Lord said, "O exalted King, give us battle in the form of a duel if you think it fitting. We are princes and have come to beg a fight. We have no other request to make of you. Over there is Bhima, son of Prita, and this is his brother Arjuna. Know me to be their maternal cousin, Krishna, your enemy." Thus challenged, Jarasandha laughed out loud and contemptuously said, "All right, you fools, I'll give you a fight. But I will not fight with you, Krishna, for you are a coward. Your strength abandoned you in the midst of battle, and you fled your own capital of Mathura to take shelter in the sea. As for this one, Arjuna, he is not as old as I, nor is he very strong. Since he is no match for me, he should not be the contender. Bhima, however, is as strong as I am." Having said this, Jarasandha offered Bhimasen a huge club, took up another himself, and went outside the city. The two heroes thus began battling each other on the level fighting grounds outside the city. Maddened with the fury of combat, they struck each other with their lightning bolt-like clubs. As they skillfully circled left and right, like actors dancing on a stage, the fight presented a magnificent spectacle. When Jarasandha's and Bhimasen's clubs loudly collided, O King, they sounded like the impact of the big tusks of two fighting elephants, or like the crash of a thunderbolt in a flashing electrical storm. They swung their clubs at each other with such speed and force that as the clubs struck their shoulders, hips, feet, hands, thighs, and collarbones, the weapons were crushed and broken like branches of arca trees with which two enraged elephants furiously attack each other. Their clubs thus ruined, those great heroes among men angrily pummeled each other with their iron-hard fists. As they slapped each other, the sound resembled the crash of elephants colliding or harsh thunderclaps. As they thus fought, this contest between opponents of equal training, strength, and stamina reached no conclusion, and so they kept on fighting, O King, without any let-up. They continued to fight for 27 days. At the end of each day's fighting, both lived at night as friends in Jarasandha's palace. Then, on the 28th day, Bhima told his maternal cousin, "Madhava, I cannot defeat Jarasandha in battle." Lord Krishna knew the secret of his enemy Jarasandha's birth and death, and also how he had been given life by the demoness Jara. Considering all this, Lord Krishna imparted his special power to Bhima. Having determined how to kill the enemy, that lord of infallible vision made a sign to Bhima by tearing in half a small branch of a tree. Understanding this sign, mighty Bhima, the best of fighters, seized his opponent by the feet and threw him to the ground. Bhima pressed down on one leg with his foot while grabbing Jarasandha's other leg in his hands, and just as a great elephant might break the branch of a tree, Bhima tore Jarasandha apart from the anus upward. The king's subjects then saw him lying in two separate pieces, each with a single leg, thigh, testicle, hip, shoulder, arm, eye, eyebrow, and ear, and with half a back and chest. With the death of the lord of Magadha, a great cry of lamentation arose, while Arjuna and Krishna congratulated Bhima by embracing him. The immeasurable supreme personality of Godhead, the sustainer and benefactor of all living beings, coronated Jarasandha's son, Sahadev, as the new ruler of the Magadhas. The lord then freed all the kings Jarasandha had imprisoned. Chapter 73. Lord Krishna blesses the liberated kings. Shukadev Goswami said, "Jarasandha had defeated 20,800 kings in combat and thrown them into prison. As these kings emerged from the Giridroni fortress, they appeared dirty and shabbily dressed. They were emaciated by hunger, their faces were dried up, and they were greatly weakened by their long imprisonment. The kings then beheld the lord before them. His complexion was dark blue like the color of a cloud, and he wore a yellow silk garment. He was distinguished by the Shrivat's mark on his chest, his four mighty arms, the pinkish hue of his eyes, which resembled the whirl of a lotus, his lovely, cheerful face, his gleaming makara earrings, and the lotus, club, conch shell, and disc in his hands. A helmet, a jeweled necklace, a golden belt, and golden bracelets and armlets decorated his form, and on his neck he wore both the brilliant precious Kaustubha gem and a garland of forest flowers. The kings seemed to drink his beauty with their eyes, lick him with their tongues, relish his fragrance with their nostrils, and embrace him with their arms. Their past sins now eradicated, the kings all bowed down to Lord Hari, placing their heads at his feet. The ecstasy of beholding Lord Krishna having dispelled the weariness of their imprisonment, the kings stood with joined palms and offered words of praise to that supreme master of the senses. The king said, Obeisances to you, O Lord of the ruling demigods, O destroyer of your surrendered devotees' distress. Since we have surrendered to you, O inexhaustible Krishna, please save us from this terrible material life which has made us so despondent. O Master Madhusudan, we do not blame this king of Magadha, since it is actually by your mercy that kings fall from their royal position, O Almighty Lord. Infatuated with his opulence and ruling power, a king loses all self-restraint and cannot obtain his true welfare. Thus bewildered by your illusory energy, he imagines his temporary assets to be permanent. Just as men of childish intelligence consider a mirage in the desert to be a pond of water, so those who are irrational look upon the illusory transformations of Maya as substantial. Previously, blinded by the intoxication of riches, we wanted to conquer this earth, and thus we fought one another to achieve victory, mercilessly harassing our own subjects. We arrogantly disregarded you, O Lord, who stood before us as death. But now, O Krishna, that powerful form of yours called time, moving mysteriously and irresistibly, has deprived us of our opulences. Now that you have mercifully destroyed our pride, we beg simply to remember your lotus feet. Never again will we hanker for a mirage-like kingdom, a kingdom that must be slavishly served by this mortal body, which is simply a source of disease and suffering, and which is declining at every moment. Nor, O Almighty Lord, will we hanker to enjoy the heavenly fruits of pious work in the next life, since the promise of such rewards is simply an empty enticement for the ears. Please tell us how we may constantly remember your lotus feet, though we continue in the cycle of birth and death in this world. Again and again we offer our obeisances unto Lord Krishna, Hari, the son of Vasudev. That supreme soul, Govinda, vanquishes the suffering of all who surrender to him. Shukadev Goswami said, thus the kings, now freed from bondage, glorified the Supreme Lord. Then, my dear Parikshit, that merciful bestower of shelter spoke to them in a gentle voice. From now on, my dear kings, you will have firm devotion to me, the Supreme Self and the Lord of all that be. I assure you this will come to pass, just as you desire. Fortunately, you have come to the proper conclusion, my dear kings, and what you have spoken is true. I can see that human beings' lack of self-restraint, which arises from their intoxication with opulence and power, simply leads to madness. Haihaya, Nahusha, Vena, Ravana, Naraka, and many other rulers of demigods, men, and demons fell from their elevated positions because of infatuation with material opulence. Understanding that this material body and everything connected with it have a beginning and an end, worship me by Vedic sacrifices, and with clear intelligence protect your subjects in accordance with the principles of religion. As you live your lives, begetting generations of progeny and encountering happiness and distress, birth and death, always keep your minds fixed on me. Be detached from the body and everything connected to it. Remaining self-satisfied, steadfastly keep your vows while concentrating your minds fully on me. In this way, you will ultimately attain me, the Supreme Absolute Truth. Shukadev Goswami said, having thus instructed the kings, Lord Krishna, the Supreme Master of all the worlds, engaged male and female servants in bathing and grooming them. The Lord then had King Sahadev honor them with offerings of clothing, jewelry, garlands, and sandalwood paste, all suitable for royalty. After they had been properly bathed and adorned, Lord Krishna saw to it that they dined on excellent food. He also presented them with various items befitting the pleasure of kings, such as betel nut. Honored by Lord Mukunda and freed from tribulation, the kings shone splendidly, their earrings gleaming, just as the moon and other celestial bodies shine brilliantly in the sky at the end of the rainy season. Then the Lord arranged for the kings to be seated on chariots drawn by fine horses and adorned with jewels and gold. And pleasing them with gracious words, he sent them off to their own kingdoms. Thus liberated from all difficulty by Krishna, the greatest of personalities, the kings departed. And as they went, they thought only of him, the Lord of the universe, and of his wonderful deeds. The kings told their ministers and other associates what the personality of Godhead had done, and they diligently carried out the orders he had imparted to them. Having arranged for Bhimasen to kill Jarasandh, Lord Keshava accepted worship from King Sahadev and then departed with the two sons of Prita. When they arrived at Indraprastha, the victorious heroes blew their conch shells, bringing joy to their well-wishing friends and sorrow to their enemies. The residents of Indraprastha were very pleased to hear that sound, for they understood that now the king of Magadha had been put to rest. King Yudhisthira felt that his desires were now fulfilled. Bhima, Arjuna, and Janardhan offered their respects to the king and informed him fully about what they had done. Upon hearing their account of the great favor Lord Kesava had mercifully shown him, King Yudhisthira shed tears of ecstasy. He felt such love that he could not say anything. Chapter 74, The Deliverance of Shishupal at the Rajasuya Sacrifice. Shukadev Goswami said, "Having thus heard of the killing of Jarasandh, and also of Almighty Krishna's wonderful power, King Yudhisthira addressed the Lord as follows with great pleasure. All the exalted spiritual masters of the three worlds, together with the inhabitants and rulers of the various planets, carry on their heads your command, which is rarely obtained. That you, the lotus-eyed Supreme Lord, accept the orders of wretched fools who presume themselves rulers is a great pretense on your part, O All-Pervading One. But of course, the power of the Absolute Truth, the Supreme Soul, the Primeval One without a second, is neither increased nor diminished by his activities, any more than the sun's power is by its movements. O unconquerable Madhava, even your devotees make no distinctions of I and mine, you and yours, for this is the perverted mentality of animals." Having said this, King Yudhisthira waited until the proper time for the sacrifice was at hand. Then, with Lord Krishna's permission, he selected suitable priests, all expert authorities on the Vedas, to execute the sacrifice. He selected Krishnadvaipayana, Bharadvaj, Sumantu, Gautama, and Asita, along with Vasishta, Chavana, Kanva, Maitreya, Kavasha, and Trita. He also selected Vishvamitra, Vamadev, Sumati, Jaimini, Kratu, Pila, and Parashara, as well as Garga, Vaishampayana, Atharva, Kashyapa, Daumya, Rama of the Bhargavas, Asuri, Vitihotra, Madhuchunda, Virasena, and Akutagvana. O King, others who were invited included Drona, Bhishma, Kripa, Dhritarashtra with his sons, the wise Vidura, and many other Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, all eager to witness the sacrifice. Indeed, all the kings came there with their entourages. The Brahmin priests then plowed the sacrificial ground with golden plowshares and initiated King Yudhisthira for the sacrifice in accordance with the traditions set down by standard authorities. The utensils used in the sacrifice were made of gold, just as in the ancient Rajasuya performed by Lord Varuna. Indra, Brahma, Shiva, and many other planetary rulers, the Siddhas and Gandharvas with their entourage, the Vidyadharas, great serpents, sages, yakshas, rakshasas, celestial birds, kinnaras, charanas, and earthly kings, all were invited, and indeed they all came from every direction to the Rajasuya sacrifice of King Yudhisthira, the son of Pandu. They were not in the least astonished to see the opulence of the sacrifice, since it was quite appropriate for the devotee of Lord Krishna. The priests, as powerful as gods, performed the Rajasuya sacrifice for King Yudhisthira in accordance with the Vedic injunctions, just as the demigods had previously performed it for Varuna. On the day of extracting the soma juice, King Yudhisthira properly and very attentively worshipped the priests and the most exalted personalities of the assembly. The members of the assembly then pondered over who among them should be worshipped first, but since there were many personalities qualified for this honor, they were unable to decide. Finally, Sahadev spoke up. "Certainly it is Achyuta, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Chief of the Yadavas, who deserves the highest position. In truth, he himself comprises all the demigods worshipped in the sacrifice, along with such aspects of the worship as the sacred place, the time, and the paraphernalia. This entire universe is founded upon him, as are the great sacrificial performances with their sacred fires, oblations, and mantras. Sankhya and Yoga both aim toward him, the one without a second. O assembly members, that unborn Lord, relying solely on himself, creates, maintains, and destroys this cosmos by his personal energies, and thus the existence of this universe depends on him alone. He creates the many activities of this world, and thus by his grace the whole world endeavors for the ideals of religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. Therefore, we should give the highest honor to Krishna, the Supreme Lord. If we do so, we will be honoring all living beings and also our own selves. Anyone who wishes the honor he gives to be reciprocated infinitely should honor Krishna, the perfectly peaceful and perfectly complete soul of all beings, the Supreme Lord, who views nothing as separate from himself. Having said this, Sahadev, who understood Lord Krishna's powers, fell silent. And having heard his words, all the saintly persons present congratulated him, exclaiming, "Excellent! Excellent!" The king was delighted to hear this pronouncement of the Brahmins, from which he understood the mood of the entire assembly. Overwhelmed with love, he fully worshipped Lord Krishna, the master of the senses. After bathing Lord Krishna's feet, Maharaj Yudhisthira joyfully sprinkled the water upon his own head, and then upon the heads of his wife, brothers, other family members, and ministers. That water purifies the whole world. As he honored the Lord with presentations of yellow silken garments and precious jeweled ornaments, the king's tear-filled eyes prevented him from looking directly at the Lord. When they saw Lord Krishna thus honored, nearly all who were present joined their palms reverentially, exclaiming, "Obeisances to you! All victory to you!" And then they bowed down to him. Flowers rained down from above. The intolerant son of Dhammaghosh became infuriated upon hearing the glorification of Lord Krishna's transcendental qualities. He stood up from his seat, and angrily waving his arms, he fearlessly spoke to the entire assembly the following harsh words against the Supreme Lord. "The statement of the Vedas that time is the unavoidable controller of all has indeed been proven true, since the intelligence of wise elders has now become diverted by the words of a mere boy. O leaders of the assembly, you know best who is a fit candidate for being honored. Therefore, you should not heed the words of a child when he claims that Krishna deserves to be worshipped. How can you pass over the most exalted members of this assembly, topmost sages dedicated to the absolute truth, endowed with powers of austerity, divine insight, and strict adherence to severe vows, sanctified by knowledge and worshipped even by the rulers of the universe? How does this coward boy, the disgrace of his family, deserve your worship, any more than a crow deserves to eat the sacred puttadasa rice cake? How does one who follows no principles of the social and spiritual orders or of family ethics, who has been excluded from all religious duties, who behaves whimsically and who has no good qualities, how does such a person deserve to be worshipped? Yayati cursed the dynasty of these Yadavas, and ever since then they have been ostracized by honest men and addicted to liquor. How then does Krishna deserve to be worshipped? These Yadavas have abandoned the holy lands inhabited by saintly sages and have instead taken shelter of a fortress in the sea, a place where no Brahminical principles are observed. There, just like thieves, they harass their subjects." Bereft of all good fortune, Shishupal spoke these and other insults. But the Supreme Lord said nothing, just as a lion ignores a jackal's cry. Upon hearing such intolerable blasphemy of the Lord, several members of the assembly covered their ears and walked out, angrily cursing the king of Chedi. Anyone who fails to immediately leave the place where he hears criticism of the Supreme Lord or his faithful devotee will certainly fall down, bereft of his pious credit. Then the sons of Pandu became furious, and together with the warriors of the Matsya, Kaikeya, and Swindriya clans, they rose up from their seats with weapons poised, ready to kill Shishupal. Undaunted, Shishupal then took up his sword and shield in the midst of all the assembled kings, and he hurled insults at those who sided with Krishna. At that point, the Supreme Lord stood up and checked his devotees. He then angrily sent forth his razor-sharp disc and severed the head of his enemy as he was attacking. When Shishupal was thus killed, a great roar and howl went up from the crowd. Taking advantage of that disturbance, the few kings who were supporters of Shishupal quickly left the assembly out of fear for their lives. An effulgent light rose from Shishupal's body, and as everyone watched, entered Lord Krishna just like a meteor falling from the sky to the earth. Obsessed with hatred of Lord Krishna throughout three lifetimes, Shishupal obtained the Lord's transcendental nature. Indeed, one's consciousness determines one's future birth. King Yudhishthira gave generous gifts to the sacrificial priests and the members of the assembly, properly honoring them all in the manner prescribed by the Vedas. He then took the Avabhrita bath. Thus Sri Krishna, the Lord of all masters of mystic yoga, saw to the successful execution of this great sacrifice on behalf of King Yudhishthira. Afterwards, the Lord stayed with his intimate friends for a few months at their earnest request. Then the Lord, the son of Devaki, took the reluctant permission of the king and returned to his capital with his wives and ministers. I have already described to you in detail the history of the two residents of Vaikuntha who had to undergo repeated births in the material world because of being cursed by Brahmins. Purified in the final Avabhrita ritual, which marked the successful completion of the Rajasuya sacrifice, King Yudhishthira shone among the assembled Brahmins and Kshatriyas like the king of the demigods himself. The demigods, humans, and residents of intermediate heavens, all properly honored by the king, happily set off for their respective domains while singing the praises of Lord Krishna and the great sacrifice. All were satisfied except sinful Duryodhana, the personification of the age of quarrel and the disease of the Kuru dynasty. He could not bear to see the flourishing opulence of the son of Pandu. One who recites these activities of Lord Vishnu, including the killing of Shishupal, the deliverance of the kings, and the performance of the Rajasuya sacrifice, is freed from all sins. Chapter 75, Duryodhana Humiliated. King Parikshit said, O Brahman, according to what I have heard from you, all the assembled kings, sages, and demigods were delighted to see the wonderful festivities of King Yudhishthira's Rajasuya sacrifice, with the sole exception of Duryodhana. Please tell me why this was so, my lord. Sri Badarayani said, At the Rajasuya sacrifice of your saintly grandfather, his family members, bound by their love for him, engaged themselves in humble services on his behalf. Bhima supervised the kitchen. Duryodhana looked after the treasury, while Sahadev respectfully greeted the arriving guests. Nakula procured needed items, Arjuna attended the respectable elders, and Krishna washed everyone's feet, while Draupadi served food and generous Karna gave out the gifts. Many others, such as Duryodhan, Vikarna, Hardikya, Vidura, Bhuri Shrava, and other sons of Balika, and Sundardhan, similarly volunteered for various duties during the elaborate sacrifice. They did so because of their eagerness to please Maharaj Yudhishthira, O best of kings. After the priests, the prominent delegates, the greatly learned saints, and the king's most intimate well-wishers had all been properly honored with pleasing words, auspicious offerings, and various gifts as remuneration, and after the king of Chedi had entered the lotus feet of the lord of the Satpatas, the Avabhrita bath was performed in the divine river Yamuna. During the Avabhrita celebration, the music of many kinds of instruments resounded, including mridangas, conch shells, panavas, tunduris, kettle drums, and gomukha horns. Female dancers danced with great joy, and choruses sang, while the loud vibrations of veenas, flutes, and hand cymbals reached all the way to the heavenly regions. All the kings, wearing gold necklaces, then set off for the Yamuna. They had flags and banners of various colors and were accompanied by infantrymen and well-adorned soldiers riding lordly elephants, chariots, and horses. The massed armies of the Yadus, Sunjayas, Kambojas, Kurus, Kekiyas, and Koshalas made the earth tremble as they followed Yudhishthira Maharaj, the performer of the sacrifice, in procession. The assembled officials, the priests, and the other excellent Brahmins resoundingly vibrated Vedic mantras, while the demigods, divine sages, pitas, and gandharvas sang praises and rained down flowers. Men and women, all adorned with sandalwood paste, flower garlands, jewelry, and fine clothing, sported by smearing and sprinkling one another with various liquids. The men smeared the courtesans with plentiful oil, yogurt, perfumed water, turmeric, and kumkum powder, and the courtesans playfully smeared the men with the same substances. Surrounded by guards, King Yudhishthira's queens came out on their chariots to see the fun, just as the demigods' wives appeared in the sky in celestial airplanes. As maternal cousins and intimate friends sprinkled the queens with liquids, the ladies' faces bloomed with shy smiles, enhancing the queen's splendid beauty. As the queens squirted water from syringes at their brothers-in-law and other male companions, their own garments became drenched, revealing their arms, breasts, thighs, and waists. In their excitement, the flowers fell from their loosened braids. By these charming pastimes, they agitated those with contaminated consciousness. The emperor, mounted upon his chariot drawn by excellent horses wearing golden collars, appeared splendid in the company of his wives, just like the brilliant Rajasuya sacrifice surrounded by its various rituals. The priests led the king through the execution of the final rituals of Patni Samyaja and Avavritya. Then they had him and Queen Draupadi sip water for purification and bathe in the Ganges. The kettle drums of the gods resounded along with those of human beings. Demigods, sages, forefathers, and humans all poured down showers of flowers. All the citizens belonging to the various orders of Varna and Ashram then bathed in that place, where even the most grievous sinner can immediately be freed from all sinful reactions. Next, the king put on new silken garments and adorned himself with fine jewelry. He then honored the priests, assembly officials, learned Brahmins, and other guests by presenting them with ornaments and clothing. In various ways, King Yudhisthira, who had totally dedicated his life to Lord Narayan, continuously honored his relatives, his immediate family, the other kings, his friends and well-wishers, and all others present as well. All the men there shone like demigods. They were adorned with jeweled earrings, flower garlands, turbans, waistcoats, silk dhotis, and valuable pearl necklaces. The lovely faces of the women were beautified by their matched earrings and locks of hair, and they all wore golden belts. Then the highly cultured priests, the great Vedic authorities who had served as sacrificial witnesses, the specially invited kings, the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, demigods, sages, forefathers, and mystic spirits, and the chief planetary rulers and their followers, all of them, having been worshipped by King Yudhisthira, took his permission and departed, each for his own abode. As they all glorified the wonderful Rajasuya Jagya performed by that great saintly king and servant of Lord Hari, they were not satiated, just as an ordinary man is never satiated when drinking nectar. At that time, King Yudhisthira stopped a number of his friends, immediate family members, and other relatives from departing, among them Lord Krishna. Out of love, Yudhisthira could not let them go, for he felt the pain of imminent separation. My dear Parikshit, the Supreme Lord remained there for some time to please the king, after first sending Samba and the other Yadu heroes back to Dwarka. Thus King Yudhisthira, the son of Dharma, was at last relieved of his burning ambition, having by the grace of Lord Krishna successfully crossed the vast and formidable ocean of his desires. One day, Duryodhana, while observing the riches of King Yudhisthira's palace, felt greatly disturbed by the magnificence of both the Rajasuya sacrifice and its performer, the king, whose life and soul was Lord Achyuta. In that palace, all the collective opulences of the kings of men, demons, and gods were brilliantly manifest, having been brought there by the cosmic inventor, Mayadhanava. With those riches, Draupadi served her husbands, and Duryodhana, the prince of the Kurus, lamented because he was very much attracted to her. Lord Krishna's thousands of queens were also staying in the palace. Their feet moved slowly, weighed down by their hips, and the bells on their feet tinkled charmingly. Their waists were very slender, the kumkum from their breasts reddened their pearl necklaces, and their swaying earrings and flowing locks of hair enhanced the exquisite beauty of their faces. It so happened that Emperor Yudhisthira, the son of Dharma, was sitting just like Indra on a golden throne in the assembly hall built by Mayadhanava. Present with him were his attendants and family members, and also Lord Krishna, his special eye. Displaying the opulences of Brahma himself, King Yudhisthira was being praised by the court poets. Proud Duryodhana, holding a sword in his hand and wearing a crown and necklace, angrily went into the palace in the company of his brothers, insulting the doorkeepers as he entered. Bewildered by the illusions created through Mayadhanava's magic, Duryodhana mistook the solid floor for water and lifted the end of his garment, and elsewhere he fell into the water, mistaking it for the solid floor. My dear Parikshit, Bhima laughed to see this, and so did the women, kings, and others. King Yudhisthira tried to stop them, but Lord Krishna showed his approval. Humiliated and burning with anger, Duryodhana turned his face down, left without uttering a word, and went back to Hastinapur. The saintly persons present loudly cried out, "Alas, alas! and King Yudhisthira were somewhat saddened, but the Supreme Lord, whose mere glance had bewildered Duryodhana, remained silent, for his intention was to remove the burden of the earth. I have now replied to your question, O King, concerning why Duryodhana was dissatisfied on the occasion of the great Rajasuya sacrifice. Chapter 76, The Battle Between Shalva and the Vrishnis. Shukadeva Goswami said, Now please hear, O King, another wondrous deed performed by Lord Krishna, who appeared in his human-like body to enjoy transcendental pastimes. Hear how he killed the master of Shalva. Shalva was a friend of Shishupal's. When he attended the wedding of Rukmini, the other warriors defeated him in battle, along with Jarasandha and the other kings. Shalva swore in the presence of all the kings, I will rid the earth of Yadavas, just see my prowess. Having thus made his vow, the foolish king proceeded to worship Lord Shiva as his deity by eating a handful of dust each day and nothing more. The great Lord Shiva is known as he who is quickly pleased, yet only at the end of a whole year did he gratify Shalva, who had approached him for shelter, by offering him a choice of benedictions. Shalva chose a vehicle that could be destroyed by neither demigods, demons, humans, Gandharvas, Urugas, nor Rakshasas, that could travel anywhere he wished to go, and that would terrify the Vrishnis. Lord Shiva said, So be it. On his order, Mayadhanava, who conquers his enemy's cities, constructed a flying iron city named Shalva and presented it to Shalva. This unassailable vehicle was filled with darkness and could go anywhere. Upon obtaining it, Shalva went to Dwaraka, remembering the Vrishni's enmity toward him. Shalva besieged the city with a large army, decimating the outlying parks and gardens, the mansions along with their observatories, towering gateways and surrounding walls, and also the public recreational areas. From his excellent airship, he threw down a torrent of weapons, including stones, tree trunks, thunderbolts, snakes, and hailstones. A fierce whirlwind arose and blanketed all directions with dust. Thus terribly tormented by the airship Shalva, Lord Krishna's city had no peace, just like the earth when it was attacked by the three aerial cities of the demons. Seeing his subjects so harassed, the glorious and heroic Lord Pradyumna told them, Do not fear, and mounted his chariot. The chief commanders of the chariot warriors, Satyaki, Charudeshna, Samba, Akrura, and his younger brothers, along with Hardikya, Bhanuvinda, Gada, Shuka, and Sarana, went out of the city with many other eminent bowmen, all girded in armor and protected by contingents of soldiers riding on chariots, elephants, and horses, and also by companies of infantry. A tumultuous, hair-raising battle then commenced between Shalva's forces and the Yadus. It equaled the great battles between the demons and the demigods. With his divine weapons, Pradyumna instantly destroyed all of Shalva's magic illusions, in the same way that the warm rays of the sun dissipate the darkness of night. Lord Pradyumna's arrows all had gold shafts, iron heads, and perfectly smooth joints. With 25 of them, he struck down Shalva's commander-in-chief, Duman, and with 100 he struck Shalva himself. Then he pierced Shalva's officers with one arrow each, his chariot drivers with 10 arrows each, and his horses and other carriers with 3 arrows each. When they saw the glorious Pradyumna perform that amazing and mighty feat, all the soldiers on both sides praised him. At one moment, the magic airship built by Mayadhanava appeared in many identical forms, and the next moment it was again only one. Sometimes it was visible, and sometimes not. Thus Shalva's opponents could never be sure where it was. From one moment to the next, the Shalva airship appeared on the earth, in the sky, on a mountain peak, or in the water. Like a whirling, flaming baton, it never remained in any one place. Wherever Shalva appeared with his Shalva ship and his army, there the Yadu commanders would shoot their arrows. Shalva became bewildered upon seeing his army and aerial city thus harassed by his enemy's arrows, which struck like fire and the sun, and were as intolerable as snake venom. Because the heroes of the Vrishni clan were eager for a victory in this world and the next, they did not abandon their assigned posts on the battlefield, even though the downpour of weapons hurled by Shalva's commanders tormented them. Shalva's minister Duman, previously wounded by Sri Pradyumna, now ran up to him and, roaring loudly, struck him with his club of black steel. Pajumna's driver, the son of Daruka, thought that his valiant master's chest had been shattered by the club. Knowing well his religious duty, he removed Pajumna from the battlefield. Quickly regaining consciousness, Lord Krishna's son Pajumna said to his charioteer, "O driver, this is abominable, for me to have been removed from the battlefield. Except for me, no one born in the Yadu dynasty has ever been known to abandon the battlefield. My reputation has now been stained by a driver who thinks like a eunuch. What will I say to my fathers, Rama and Keshava, when I return to them after having simply fled the battle? What can I tell them that will befit my honor? Certainly my sisters-in-law will laugh at me and say, 'O hero, tell us how in the world your enemies turned you into such a coward in battle.'" The driver replied, "O long-lived one, I have done this knowing full well my prescribed duty. O my lord, the chariot driver must protect the master of the chariot when he is in danger, and the master must also protect his driver. With this rule in mind, I removed you from the battlefield, since you had been struck unconscious by your enemy's club, and I thought you were seriously injured." Chapter 77. Lord Krishna slays the demon Shalva. Shukadeva Goswami said, "After refreshing himself with water, putting on his armor, and picking up his bow, Lord Pradyumna told his driver, 'Take me back to where the hero Duman is standing.' In Pradyumna's absence, Duman had been devastating his army, but now Pradyumna counterattacked Duman and, smiling, pierced him with 8 Naracha arrows. With 4 of these arrows, he struck Duman's 4 horses, with 1 arrow, his driver, with 2 more arrows, his bow and chariot flag, and with the last arrow, Duman's head. Gada, Saptiki, Samba, and others began killing Shalva's army, and thus all the soldiers inside the airship began falling into the ocean, their necks severed. As the Yadus and Shalva's followers thus went on attacking one another, the tumultuous, fearsome battle continued for 27 days and nights. Invited by Yudhisthira, the son of Dharma, Lord Krishna had gone to Indraprastha. Now that the Rajasuya sacrifice had been completed and Shishupal killed, the Lord began to see inauspicious omens. So he took leave of the Kuru elders and the great sages, and also of Prita and her sons, and returned to Dwaraka. The Lord said to himself, "Because I have come here with my respected elder brother, kings partial to Shishupal may well be attacking my capital city." After Krishna arrived at Dwaraka and saw how his people were threatened with destruction, and also saw Shalva and his Salva airship, Lord Keshava arranged for the city's defense and then addressed Dwaraka as follows: "O driver, quickly take my chariot near Shalva. This lord of Salva is a powerful magician. Don't let him bewilder you." Thus ordered, Dwaraka took command of the lord's chariot and drove forth. As the chariot entered the battlefield, everyone there, both friend and foe, caught sight of the emblem of Garuda. When Shalva, the master of a decimated army, saw Lord Krishna approaching, he hurled his spear at the lord's charioteer. The spear roared frighteningly as it flew across the battlefield. Shalva's hurtling spear lit up the whole sky like a mighty meteor, but Lord Krishna tore the great weapon into hundreds of pieces with his arrows. Krishna then pierced Shalva with 16 arrows and struck the Salva airship with a deluge of arrows as it darted about the sky. Firing his arrows, the Lord appeared like the sun flooding the heavens with its rays. Shalva then managed to strike Lord Krishna's left arm, which held his bow Shanga, and amazingly, Shanga fell from his hand. Those who witnessed this all cried out in dismay. Then the master of Salva roared loudly and addressed Lord Janardhan, "You fool! Because in our presence you kidnapped the bride of our friend Shishupal, your own cousin, and because you later murdered him in the sacred assembly while he was inattentive, today with my sharp arrows I will send you to the land of no return. Though you think yourself invincible, I will kill you now if you dare stand before me." The Supreme Lord said, "O dullard, you boast in vain, since you fail to see death standing near you. Real heroes do not talk much, but rather show their prowess in action." Having said this, the furious lord swung his club with frightening power and speed and hit Shalva on the collarbone, making him tremble and vomit blood. But as soon as Lord Krishna withdrew his club, Shalva disappeared from sight, and a moment later a man approached the Lord. Bowing his head down to him, he announced, "Devaki has sent me." And sobbing, he spoke the following words, "O Krishna, Krishna, mighty armed one, who are so affectionate to your parents, Shalva has seized your father and taken him away, as a butcher leads an animal to slaughter." When he heard this disturbing news, Krishna, who was playing the role of a mortal man, showed sorrow and compassion, and out of love for his parents, he spoke the following words like an ordinary conditioned soul. "Balaram is ever vigilant, and no demigod or demon can defeat him. So how could this insignificant Shalva defeat him and abduct my father? Indeed, fate is all-powerful." After Govinda spoke these words, the master of Shalva again appeared, apparently leading Vasudev before the Lord. Shalva then spoke as follows, "Here is your dear father, who begot you and for whose sake you are living in this world. I shall now kill him before your very eyes. Save him if you can, weakling." After he had mocked the Lord in this way, the magician Shalva appeared to cut off Vasudev's head with his sword. Taking the head with him, he entered the Shalva vehicle, which was hovering in the sky. By nature, Lord Krishna is full in knowledge, and he possesses unlimited powers of perception. Yet, for a moment, out of great affection for his loved ones, he remained absorbed in the mood of an ordinary human being. He soon recalled, however, that this was all a demoniac illusion engineered by Mayadhanava and employed by Shalva.